Okay, I was told to do an introduction or an overview of the ADS correspondence, so this is really an introduction to the overview.
It's not
that. Okay. Oh, that's good. Okay. So this is really an introduction to the overview. I understand since Sir John Ray is here, he'll be able to give a second part, a third, because Joe will give another introduction also, or an overview tomorrow, or Friday.
Oh, that's kind of an overview for the defense matter people.
So that probably will complement all this two talks that we will have.
They give you 20 minutes, so it's...
Oh, it will be short. Okay, I have an hour or so. Nevertheless, it's a huge subject, and so I had to choose even how to give this introduction, and the choice was easy. It comes from a personal perspective, and I will tell you how I think of the ADS-CFT correspondence. It's worth emphasizing that even though the name sounds so technical, ADS-CFT, but this has been the main line of research for about, since I was a graduate student, so I should quickly give you the necessary historical background, which as soon as dual models were introduced, there were people right away who were thinking that maybe there is a local field theory behind dual models. And that was around 1969. Sakita, Milson, Virasoro introduced the idea of trying to reproduce dual models from fishnet diagrams. And that idea was in a way great. That is what we have been doing all these years in just greater precision and greater details. The first kind of real result was Hoofs, who was able to compute the strength of the dual model, or rather the strength of the string coupling being 1 over n, and that is a real number, not just a picture which people before him had. In the 80s, there were then real very formal and very large-scale attempts to solve large n Young-Mills theory. And that's where many of the ideas like loop space and collective fields or master fields or Iguchi Kawai all came up. But it was a frustrating time in a way, because even though the efforts were large, progress has been very, very small. And the first real progress then came in 90s, so it always took time as we look back. In 1990s, where the first case of a correspondence was established, that correspondence showed that a one-dimensional matrix model, almost the simplest that we can think of, would be related to a two-dimensional string theory. And in that case, one was able to present the explicit construction of such a correspondence. Okay. There was a totally new idea which came into this game in 1996, and that's Polchinski's idea of D-brains. It at first looked like stands away from the subject which I was lining up, but precisely because it stood away from the main line of just efforts to solve large n equations, it allowed us, it allowed everyone to look at things differently, and that is really responsible for much of the progress which came after that. And it in a way starts from the other side, from the picture which is supposed to be shown from large n. It starts from the fact that in gravity one had deep brains or extended objects, classical solutions, much like solitons. And those solitons will be described by collective coordinates representing their positions. and the symmetry which governs those coordinates, which naively could have been just a permutation symmetry of Sn, which is still a non-abelian group, but through a very interesting phenomena, that group grows to a un. I think in a manner which maybe technically we understand, but maybe at a deeper level we still don't understand as well. But in any case, we are not unhappy that this description of coordinates for a D-brain, for n D-brains, is given by a theory governed by UN, because that is where Young-Mills theory comes in. So in a way, it is a derivation of, it's the opposite. If you start from a string theory or gravity, it would be a derivation of Young-Mills theory. And that indeed allowed everyone to look at the whole subject in a fresh new light, and allowed Maldacena to make this conjecture, which is very specific. That is the strength of the conjecture, and then the basic case or basic example of ADS-CFT, the strength of the conjecture is that it is so precise. It says that it is precisely this n equal 4 UN Young-Mills gauge theory supersymmetric, which is dual to type 2 10-dimensional supergravity, compactified precisely on this manifold. And even though someone as an outsider might think that this might be a drawback, in the sense that there are some, this might be just some crazy example, but in a subject where for so many years people have been wandering aimlessly all over the place, to have such a very precise statement, that has been a huge progress. So you should view that, the details of these names which come there, as an incredible progress. So I think my introduction was longer than I wanted. As I said, I had to choose topics, and I will present first a simple toy model, which I like, and which helped at least me to think about this correspondence. Now, in that toy model, one, as I emphasized before, one is able to do almost everything, actually not quite everything, but in the toy model we are able to present some of the construction. Then I will go to the real four-dimensional Young-Mills theory and discuss the ideas in that case. So the first part of the talk then will be a little bit intuitive, and if I have time, the second or later part will be more technical, where more explicit constructions will be given. So let me begin with a toy model and some maybe intuitive things which you might then which might let you think about the subject along the line which I would suggest. So the simplest thing is really just thinking of this one matrix problem. One matrix, it is gauged with A0, so there would be a Gauss law to make a projection. And it is that simplest model, which I already mentioned, can be translated into this two-dimensional field theory or two-dimensional string theory, where one of the dimensions is the time, and the other will be related in string theory to the so-called Liouville direction, very non-trivial degree of freedom, but nevertheless, that's an extra dimension. And to just also focus on some things which will be relevant for later in the more general context, you can think of a matrix model which has a Hamiltonian like that, p squared plus m squared plus lambda over m squared. If I kick out m squared, this would be scale invariant. That's the simplest example of a scale invariant problem in one dimension. So this is a linear combination of a Hamiltonian which is scale invariant, and m squared is a generator of conformal transformations. P going into t plus epsilon t squared. D is a generator of scale transformations, t going into t plus epsilon t. So this would be a linear combination of the Hamiltonian itself plus a generator of conformal transformation. All these three things, the Hamiltonian, the generator of dilatations and conformal transformation form this algebra of SL2, which you probably all well know, but since there will be some relevance, there's central relevance to this algebra in this correspondence, let me emphasize that.
Excuse me, maybe you said it, but I was not paying attention. So what is P and what is M?
Oh yes, M is just the matrix.
This large matrix.
Variable N by N.
Yes.
It is quantum mechanics, so M depends on time only. And P is M dot, which is the conjugate momentum. So there are canonical, you can think at the operator level, or even classically, they obey commutation relations, and P is M dot. And then this
lambda is a parameter.
Lambda is the coupling above the M squared. And this is just one of the simplest examples of a conformal invariant, scale invariant quantum mechanics that you might.
As I
wrote this to save space, so the Hamiltonian would be just p squared plus lambda over m squared. But as you will see as I proceed, we can choose different Hamiltonians, and the structure of what I want to say will not depend so much what the potential is.
Simplistically, we can think of it just
as p squared
plus lambda.
Yes, indeed. That is really the one.
There's no dependence on lambda, I mean. These commutation relations, the operators depend on lambda.
No, not in the commutation relations. Yes, this is. This
so for
is,
any lambda.
This is 2, and this is plus minus. And this, just as I said, I might be rushing through that, but that's okay. You should stop me down, close me down. It indeed is a kind of canonical example of conformal symmetry in quantum mechanics, if you like.
So the conformal invariance is sort of, if I had p squared plus lambda over m squared, I could always get rid of lambda by rescaling things, and that's what you
want. No, sorry.
You couldn't do this case?
No. Lambda is a coupling, so no, and in fact, maybe even I said something which is, it is the following Lagrangian, which would be m or x dot squared over 2 minus lambda over m squared, the inverse matrix, and that you have to be, you have a trace. It is this Lagrangian which is scale invariant. The dimensionality of m is 1/2. And that's why this would
cancel.
So this is just like Young-Mills theory in four dimensions, classically it's scaling invariant. And this lambda is nothing but that coupling constant which you have in Young-Mills theory. It cannot be removed by scaling. It is always there. And it generates, so if the Hamiltonian is, and as I said, p squared over 2 plus lambda over m squared, then the generator of conformals, the generator of dilatations is P times M, or P times X. That's easy, it just says that you are changing M into something proportional to M. And the generator of conformal symmetry would be M squared. And that they together close this algebra.
So now, in old-fashioned quantum mechanics, this means that any eigenstate is infinitely generated.
Yeah, this has a continuous spectrum. Okay. It doesn't have the state states.
So if I wanted to cut it off, I could add a little epsilon m squared or something.
It actually is. I in fact don't want to get into that potential. It is a very weird potential. It has some. In fact, there are some limitations of lambda should be for this Hamiltonian to be Hermitian, but all that is not relevant for us. You'll study this problem in the large and limit. And
just to answer what Michael said, you're right. For any monomial p squared plus lambda x to the n, you're right. You can scale lambda away. But when n is equal minus 2, you can't. And that's the case.
Okay.
So it's precisely that one where you cannot scale things away. Conformally invariant here.
Well, p is just formal of the lab units, so it's obvious. They're both
scaled. Yeah, yeah. We can discuss this conformally invariant quantum mechanics further.
Since we're still at the beginning, I can ask lots of naive questions. In QCD, of course, I mean, the Angular theory is not conformally invariant quantum mechanics.
It is conformally invariant classical level, and indeed, this one is. This one is better than that. It is invariant also at the quantum level.
Also the quantum, okay.
And in fact, I will never be able to talk about QCD.
Okay.
I will be only able to talk about N equal 4 supersymmetric young Mills, which is conformal. And, in that sense,
so you've given up a beautiful property of QCD that it's not conformal.
As you will see, this conformal symmetry will be of great help. So yes, we were given up. I would not say beautiful property of QCD. Given up connection with reality.
Okay.
That is probably worse. But that's what you gave up when you decide to study this subject. And then you hope that you'll be able to make the big step from here to there. And I hope Joe will be able to tell you about that at a later stage.
Well, indeed. You can make several small steps.
So it requires several steps. And probably much of the real effort at this point in time is directed in making those steps.
Okay.
Yes, we have to pay a huge price for the fact that we'll be, but that's why one is able to solve this theory, and the price is as stated. So nothing is given. You know, we are well aware of the price you pay for kind of solvability. Okay, but there is more to it than that. The fact that you can study things in this case. Obviously, it will build up your intuition for being able to study things also in conformal non-invariant theories. And people already have that intuition. So it's not that it is just a mathematical example. Okay, let me now try to make that bridge between this matrix theory, which I just emphasized, prototype matrix theory of M, I, J, and T. And he said that P, I, J is nothing but just M dot. Let's make that big step from D equal 1 to D equal 2, where we'll be able to describe that as a theory for scalar field in dimension 2 and 5 in function of x and t. And that is that dual picture, which supposedly is present in the ADS-CFT correspondence. In the ADS-CFT correspondence in general, you'll have a conformal invariant field in dimension D, and it will be dual to a theory at least in dimension D plus 1, if not more, and that will be a string theory.
Here it will also be a string theory?
Here it is also a string theory.
And
we'll comment on that. That turns out to be not the contradiction. You know, that turns out to be okay. And again, that simple map is just given by this simple observation of the fact that you should use invariants which are invariant under UN, the famous Wilson loops, that you should look at traces of the matrix m to the power n, which gives this index n right here, or if you like the Wilson loop notation, e to the ikm of t, and trace, so phi k and function of t also. It is this loop variable, which you can reformulate in several different ways. And one way would be to say that the matrix M can be diagonalized. And as we heard in the last week, the relevance of the density of eigenvalues of a random matrix, and so that field which I was mentioning for advertising is nothing but the density of eigenvalues of this random matrix. It is the same variable that was discussed last week. And that density of eigenvalues of this random matrix is nothing but the Fourier transform of those traces that I had before. So that is the scalar field. It is now in one dimension, x and t, and that is the simplest of these examples of a transmutation from one to from a certain number of dimensions to more.
That
remains to be found by solving some equation, mm-hmm. which will govern the density. The equation which governs the density is given by the Hamiltonian, which is again much like the Hamiltonian we discussed yesterday. It has the structure of so. In essence, what you do here is just change variables from variables that you had initially, m and ddm. This is canonically conjugate to m. You change variables to this phi and dd phi. And the way we viewed it long time ago was just the direct change of variables.
And what's really not intuitive is why should the phi potential term for the phi local.
So the question is now, what is how did I reach this Hamiltonian? First of all, the potential term v of x, phi of x, that is trivial. You know, that's just trace of whatever you have in your potential. That's why I said for some of the argument, it won't even matter so much what the potential is.
It's the phi cubed, and why always phi at the same point?
But here are the relevant pieces of this Hamiltonian. The first part is just classically equal to the kinetic energy of the matrix, of the original theory M dot. It is that second part, which is the phi cube again, and these are both cubic, so that's a very interesting combination. That requires a lecture, which I wouldn't do now. It is a quantum effect, number one. It comes only if you include quantum mechanics, and that is another interesting aspect which you learn in this toy model, that in the Young-Mills theory, the CFT side, it's very relevant to include quantum effects. And it is that which will be giving you classical gravity.
Mm-hmm. I guess what's not intuitive to me is if I do these manipulations, go from m to phi, generally I would think that phi at any point would couple to phi at any other point. And somehow you change
So things are absolutely, if you start making this change of variables, in the intermediate pages, you will see a lot of non-locality and non-local terms. Yes.
Can I make a comment to this? Just a little bit of discussion. One way you can see that is that when you look at the measure on the matrix M, it's the Weyl measure. So the eigenvalues, lambda 1 through lambda n, will not overlap. There's a repulsion built into the measure. Mm-hmm. And that tends to smooth out the density of the eigenvalue.
You're saying points in different space I can think of as being associated with different eigenvalues and they're sort of independent of each other or something.
If I said what x is.
X is on the top line there.
X is actually right here. It's just the Fourier transform of K. or rather, so I rather follow this formula, which is probably the best, because it says that x is nothing but m. So the fact that this was a matrix variable and the fact that I have a trace, it is a transmutation between m is x, if you like. And that, in a way, is a good lesson for more general case. If I have two matrices, obviously there will be x1 and x2, there will be two delta functions, which you should think in this kind of collective.
That notation is funny. You've got delta of x1 is m, but x is a one-dimensional variable, m is a
matrix. Right. It is not that funny if you exponentiate the delta function, and then it becomes just phi k is just trace of e to the ikm. Those are things which you use all the time. So if you think that way, maybe it's not that. But that's why I wrote down several formulas.
Maybe so used to Fourier transforms, when I start multiplying things together, immediately becoming
unfold. Yes, I know. So maybe this version. That's why there are so many versions on the transparency. One, you might like one versus the other. You might prefer to think of one formula for this field versus. Okay. But as I said, phi of k is nothing but trace of e to the ikm, the standard trace loop.
In the old days, there were all these connections between even singulations models and string theory involving triangulated wheel sheets and things like that. There has to be some connection. That work here.
Right? Probably, yes. But this will not be a Wirtschied string theory. This will be actually the field theory of things. Yeah, this is the real world string theory.
Right.
As I said, I it's just the lack of time of explaining why precisely this phi cube comes about. But very soon let's proceed to at this point, the best I can offer to you is once you change variables, such terms always appear.
Mm-hmm. It
comes from the measure and Jacobians. It is this famous centrifugal barrier, which everyone knows in quantum mechanics, once you change to radial coordinates. Just that in that case, you get the term much like that. You get the scale invariant term over R. And in this case, when you do it with matrices, you get polynomial phi q. That it's a funny thing, but nevertheless, it is true. And I think that's one thing I can offer as an explanation, but we can discuss some more details of how that appears. But let me proceed to now just try to understand the physics of this model, and then I like to really move on to the more general case, the case of Young-Mills. So the physics of the model is, obviously, since there is a linear term in the field phi, you will essentially shift by a classical background, which will be found by minimizing this phi cube versus the linear term in phi. And the equation is very simple and nice. It just says take a derivative, it is phi squared, 6 cancels out, plus v. And there is also another constant, phi squared plus v equals a constant, or phi is just square root of that constant minus v. So it is a very simple equation which covers the background. But the Hamiltonian is not so interesting looking. The Lagrangian becomes more interesting because it is indeed very nonlinear once you get rid of pi and integrate out so in terms of phi dot.
So the classical Hamiltonian measures no bottom.
Yes, but there are some further things which we have to say about this density. This density phi of x has to be such that the integral of phi is equal to n, which is number of particles, and that's where n comes into. Oh. And that has to be put in. And after that, typically it will have a bottom, except maybe in some cases which actually are of physical interest, where you have to introduce cutoffs and so on.
So is this a quantity which commutes with Hamiltonian?
Yes, that commutes to the Hamiltonian, and that's that relevant quantity, because that's how n appears. Also, I should mention, if you scale n, if you scale n out, this Lagrangian or the whole action has a very special property that if you scale n, you will have n in front like that. So this Lagrangian is very clever. It does what it complies with truth, in the sense that once you are in this picture, now the natural coupling constant G, and we call it the string coupling, is 1 over n. So it accomplishes this, so just by that simple fact, the fact that n scales out appropriately, you might already be, it might already hint to the fact that you have made a change to this same picture. Okay.
Yes. What do you do with third power of Kalman functions? Do you take
large elements by so all that, this is done in the large element, because again, you like this, the field to be kind of smooth, and anytime you, there's some interest in discussing configurations which are not smooth, where you like to separate an eigenvalue. Those have great interest too. Those are called single eigenvalue instantons. And in fact, they are the D-brains of Polchinski. But in first approximation, we think of this phi as being the smooth classical field. But to continue with the properties of this theory in this picture, as I said, the N is one of the first things one should mention. But if you look at the Lagrangian, it already and perform the shift by phi zero, you can see that phi cube which you noted. In fact, there is something very special with this Lagrangian. Once we look at the small fluctuations,
the field V, because that's essential for the shift. So where did that come from the original?
So V is nothing but my notation for the potential in this this problem. So I just wanted to emphasize that this can be done for any V as a function of M, and then you'll put in that later. The whole non-triviality of this change is not so much related to V, which you see appears always as this linear platform. At this point, it doesn't matter much. The non-triviality is in the other term, which comes from M squared. And have you... that's okay, yes. But as I said, the structure of this, the surprise, which obviously was a surprise then, and we should have known that there is something absolutely interesting in this subject, is the surprise is that once you look at the small fluctuations, they have a form of a massless scalar field, but in the presence of a background field which can be seen as a metric. It looks like a curved space of this kind, where the metric is phi zero and the other term is 1 over phi zero. And clearly that came from that structure of the two terms, one classical, one quantum, which we had in that original Hamiltonian. So if you change any of those two terms, you will not get this nice. So in a sense, you could have guessed this nonlinear Lagrangian just by the demand that you might desire to see fluctuations which are in this kind of curved space as I emphasized. Now this...
But why would you have one?
As I said, it obviously comes as a surprise. You are studying a matrix problem, there is nothing, there is no gravity. Why should you have the curved space? It should have, you might not have had the intuition of wanting it, absolutely. But in today's context, we know that matrix theories in general produce strings and gravity. Maybe not that surprised. So maybe that is the simplest place where you have got the first inkling that there is some gravity going on. Now, that is not that much gravity. The reason is that this is a masses field in two dimension, you can actually, via coordinate transformations, you can in fact get rid of that. But nevertheless, if you cannot get rid of it totally, it will tell you something about space. It will tell you, it will translate into the length of space and things like that. So there will be some global properties of the space which will have.
So that, but those are all encoded in the initial potential for the matrix model.
And obviously, if you choose some initial potential like the one I said, the scaling variant one, 1 over x squared, then it will actually be the metric of ADS states. So I'm about to comment on that, that when you commit yourself to a scaling variant problem on the mechanics side, you will get an example of a metric which will be an ADS type metric.
And that you know because of the conformal invariance.
You could have again guessed that, so I think we are catching on. You could have guessed that by just requirement of keeping conformal symmetry present. It was there initially, you want to see it in your final result. And that in the simple toy case would be the ADS, the CFT ADS correspondence.
You did go to the higher dimension by, and therefore going from the higher dimension to the lower, you integrate somehow. So it's not completely obvious that it should.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that will be one of the topics I will address. And that's sometimes confusing, because after all, the original conformal symmetry was a conformal symmetry in a one-dimensional flat space. Here you are talking about some related group, identical group, but it is realized in a different space. So the realization is different. I will actually maybe give a small argument, a kind of back of an envelope argument which will reconcile those two.
But they are related because the rescaling of M is the rescaling of the X, right? Because
yes.
The values of M are the X's.
So the formula which looks weird, but nevertheless good to write down, the formula which says that where did x come from? It was the trace of delta of x minus m, after all it was m. So conformal changes of m will induce changes of x, and it's a very convoluted way of going from a realization of symmetry in one dimension to maybe realizing the same symmetry in two. Yes, it is a convoluted translation of a symmetry in 1 to 2. But as you could see in the argument which I gave, to get that two-dimensional symmetry and to have it in this nice ADS form, quantum mechanics was rather crucial. So you had to add that quantum effect, which I have added, and it's very visible in my. That's why, as I said, this toy model does teach you some things of what was taken into account from the original theory to achieve and obtain this result.
The only thing is you seem to, because of the shifts, that you truncated the phi to the third term is truncated when you do the expansion. It seems, at least, from what you write down. You might worry that the conformal symmetry is so strong that that truncation might sort of...
Yeah. You mean this is a quadratic piece, and then there is the cubic. There are a lot of terms, yes.
But I would expect that they are important for the realization of the conformal symmetry.
No, it's realized in each order, because remember, this is that is a 1 over n expansion, and there is a coupling constant, which it should be through order by order, right. Much like the symmetry is here for any n. So it's not that the symmetry will be restored as I calculate higher order terms. It should be present in leading n. And indeed, this space, the ADS space, which has this metric, for example, the different realizations, the different coordinates, dt squared, dr squared, 1 plus r squared, and divide by the same thing, that has that just a sphere after all. The ADS space is nothing but a sphere with a couple of minus signs. So it clearly has that symmetry of SR1 or SO1, 2. Yes.
On the ADS safety example, the curvature of this space is said by the number of colors, always doing the same thing.
So, as I said, in this case, actually, you cannot judge the curvature because this is a massless scalar. So we'll come maybe to a more general example where we'll be able to judge that. Okay. So in this example, you might translate this, as I said, if you're just staring at the massless scalar field in ADS background, you in fact can gauge that background, the ratio of that scale. Okay.
The map from M to 5 was correct on the equilibrium
event? A large M, yes.
Well, so the collections, the one over n collections that you have here,
right,
are they related in any way to the 1/n collections you would have in the original matrix?
Yes, this Hamiltonian which I gave you would be good enough to calculate 1/n collections systematically.
In spite of the fact that you...
That the logic of it is kind of large n. It's a little bit tricky, but that's a subject which... But I can tell you, maybe not in philosophical terms, but in practical terms. We have done some calculations to second, third order in 1/n, and it held up after that order. Funnily enough, it held up especially when you wanted to confront it with the expansion in string theory. Then it held up very well. Okay.
Matrices are different types to
a commute.
Did you have trade-off the unitary matrices?
Yes.
It's
yes, so in a way...
And then you know what?
I skipped a number of terms. Depends how you derive this Hamiltonian, and in the derivation you will see that was that. But that would require me to discuss that in detail. So, in any case, I hope the toy model helps to give a concrete picture of what this kind of correspondence is about. But let me now precisely connect to string theory and say that what kind of string theory this would be. In particular, the choice which I mentioned already, the fact that we might study a 1/x² potential. Lambda over m squared. Some of these things were settled 10 years ago, but some of the things were settled even just as recently as last year. But just to give you an example of a very specific correspondence between now specific string theory and a specific potential, one of the theories of closed strings is called 0A, and I won't go into any detail except to say that if you look at the spectrum of that string, that is the massless tachyon, which would have been of negative mass in any other dimension but 2, but here in D equal 2 it is massless. That is a scalar field, there is a dilaton, the graviton, and then you begin with gauge fields, Ramon type gauge fields, and then higher gauge field for higher spin. So string theory has a whole set of higher gauge field, and the Lagrangian, the effective Lagrangian you might like to think of for this theory at the string side would be therefore the graviton interacting with the dilaton, tachyon, Ramon gauge fields, and as I said, infinitely many higher spins. If you took an unitary gauge and fixed the gauge for this problem, what would remain from all these fields would be that massless tachyon, the scalar field. All other things like the graviton, dilaton, and the higher spin fields can all be basically gauge fixed. And you should just have in mind another simple, well-known two-dimensional theory, the two-dimensional Young-Mills, or QED, where you know you can get rid of the gauge field. It's not that the gauge field is irrelevant. It produces Coulomb forces and produces forces, but you can eliminate them and formulate the theory only in terms of the matter field. And if you think of my Hamiltonian, the phi, that is what that Hamiltonian is. It is an exact result found, obviously, if you wanted to find it from here, you would have absolutely horrendous. In fact, we still don't know how to reproduce that Hamiltonian from string theory. But if you wanted to reproduce it from string theory, that's what you would do. You would take this with an infinite sequence of higher spin fields. You would gauge fix in a unitary Coulomb type gauge. You would end up with just one scalar field, and that is the Lagrangian which I derived. Now, that is just to tell you how great matrix theory is. It's absolutely, as I said, it's still a challenge to us to understand if the connection in this kind of a language of maybe gauge fixing the basic string Lagrangian. But nevertheless, large n is just a coupling constant which appears. So that would be just denoted as g. You can okay, and that's it. But since we cannot do that step of confronting the Hamiltonians in a unitary gauge directly, which would be great, and we have some interest in that. There are many other comparisons which can be done. And I think I am aware that I am spending too much time on this. But
don't worry about spending too much time. We're learning.
Okay. So let me mention one thing you can do to compare. So as I said, you cannot compare things by comparing the Lagrangian of string theory with the Lagrangian of, although they look consistent. You can compare an expansion in G, perturbation theory, with the expansion in 1 over M generated by the other Hamiltonian. They agree. But they agree even in some more interesting things. For example, the two-dimensional gravity or the two-dimensional string theory has a black hole solution, just to mention one of the more interesting aspects of such a comparison, has a black hole solution which was studied couple of years back and even more last year. But that black hole solution allows you to evaluate something, the mass of the black hole. Q, I was again quick, was just the flux of that gauge field which was present in that Lagrangian. And if you find the mass of that of a black hole, you will find this kind of formula, Q squared log Q squared, and then other higher cutoff dependent terms. If you evaluate the ground state of that model, which I said, which contained the 1 over x squared potential, where I just put q squared, that was the lambda which we had before. If you evaluate the ground state energy by taking that classical solution which I exhibited, phi 0, plugging it back into the energy, in fact, plugging it back into that phi cube term, and you do the integral, you'll find again q squared log q squared. So indeed, that is how you observe that indeed there is a great agreement between that matrix model Hamiltonian and some properties.
What is the effect of the covariant derivative? If you take an ordinary derivative instead of a covariant derivative in your matrix model.
You mean the fact...
The covariant derivative is dt minus...
Oh, yes. The effect is that just a hidden way of saying that we should be... we have a gauge symmetry whereby m is equivalent to v of t, and the dagger t, And that just allows you to go to the diagonal elements of this matrix. So that's just a justification. You know, I could have just said this and not put in the covariant derivative. Yeah. So it just can be implemented by saying that I have a gauge symmetry. And that is what allowed us to go to just that scalar field and nothing else. There is some interest in studying also this so-called angular degree. This would be the eigenvalues, and this would be angular degrees of freedom. And even they contain some interesting physics, which I, at this point, again, I have to work
on. It sort of plays a role in constructing the Jacobian, right?
Oh, yes. They absolutely, when you do integrate out the angular degrees of freedom. And they supply the measure in the Jacobian. So this is just one example of confronting this two-dimensional string theory with maybe a large N matrix theory like that. As I said, you could see that we made the step from this one-dimensional matrix theory to a two-dimensional field theory. And that two-dimensional field theory you can think of as a string theory, even though for strings you expect more fields than that. But in this two-dimensional case, if you think in unitary, in terms of unitary gauge, the gauge fields can all be gauge fixed. They are important and relevant, but nevertheless, there is a picture which is consistent with just having one scalar field. Even though this is a Ploy model, and it shows you this map between a simple matrix model and maybe a two-dimensional gravity or string theory, actually it plays a role even in the higher dimensional map where you will have the Young-Mills theory in four dimension with more matrices than one, and string theory in 10 dimension. There is a subset of things which appear in the full ADS map which actually are described by this kind of a simple one-dimensional matrix model. So some of this, the picture which I presented just for one matrix, remarkable, some of the picture is in precisely the same way visible even in the full 4 to 5 dimensional map. And that was understood just very recently. There's a very nice paper by Lee Lunin and Maldacena, which precisely can show you how you could see some aspects of a single matrix in Young-Mills, and then some aspects of some thing being related to that in the full five-dimensional ABS file field space here. Yeah.
In your example so far, there is no conjecture, right?
No. There is no conjecture. Everything is, in a way, it is a really brute force derivation from one side to another.
Okay. But you pass through the step of writing the string theory in terms of local fields, a kind of a low energy view of it. Is there something lost there?
Yes, indeed. There is still a conjecture that this, what we've gotten, is absolutely equivalent to a two-dimensional string theory with all the gauge fields and everything. And that is still, in a way, not proven. As I said, no one has derived that Lagrangian which I wrote from string theory. All we have done is maybe compared scattering amplitudes. I gave an example of comparing the brown state energy versus the black hole mass. So indeed, in that sense, there is still a conjecture. But there are so many checks which are so non-trivial that we don't think of it as a conjecture anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought this play, I heard it play the role of a dimension.
Yes.
And how do you have to think about that? How can it happen? It happens at a technical level, but
So I only can show you the technical level. So Indeed. If the lesson is really that we took the traces of this one matrix to the power n, and that roughly supplied an x dimension n, or if you like, in momentum space, doesn't matter. We can do it in many variants, which are closer or further. Then certainly if you have two matrices, you would say x1, it would be k1, and x2, k2. You might think that this will be two dimensions, k1 and k2, and so on. You say that doesn't sound convincing. And indeed, no one dared to make such a suggestion 10 years ago. When we knew the story of a one matrix, no one came out immediately and said, look, it is trivial. Once you have a problem with more than one matrix, like two, there will be a nice two-dimensional theory, and so on. No one made that statement then. As I said, Mandelsena made a conjecture that there is a map between the four-dimensional Young-Mills theory and the ADS space theory, but it was not based on such logic. But now looking back at what is going on in Mandelsena's conjecture, we know that what is going on is precisely that.
So there is, historically speaking, there was way before the string theory, of course, the Christopher-Gauchy-Kawai model, where there was an interesting way of getting space-time degrees of freedom where color momentum was conserved, could be interpreted as ordinary momentum. Now, this is somewhat different, but it's again related in that case to unitary matrices.
Yes,
of course, it doesn't give a string theory, but is that, do you know of any connection?
It's not even different. The Gauchy-Kawai in the context of loop space.
Yeah, you can do the quench.
No, I would call it actually precisely the same. You know, because the Gauchy-Kawai says take a matrix M1, M2, and you are able to reproduce, two-dimensional McDonald-Kodak equations. And obviously you are reproducing the space of present in the McDonald-Kodak equation. So yes, no, that is the same phenomenon. No.
It sounds like
which
landscape we may find more exciting the statement, because for us, Atlantis has lots of matrices. Each matrix gives you an extra dimension. We soon exceed.
So let me quickly put that problem to let me pacify you on that problem. There is something remarkable going on which I don't think we understand well, but in the full Young-Mills theory, n equal 4 super Young-Mills, and let me jump to that right away and think of have more to say about that. That theory has six scalar fields, the so-called Higgs fields, and then the gauge field and other fermions and so on. But the major role is played by the six scalars, and then obviously there are the four gauge fields, and you can, if you like, you can trade in those four a la Gauchy-Kawai for again. And they are all in four dimensions. But there is some kind of reduction going on which we don't know. Many of the aspects of the correspondence of this Young-Mills theory to a 10-dimensional string theory. And many of the aspects can be obtained from just thinking not of all these matrices at all points of x, but some kind of a reduction to just maybe time. The time which you have to think is the time it generates the rotations. But there is some reduction going on. And I think this reduced Young-Mills model with six matrices and then a couple more from A, the I, they have
pretty much what you need to reproduce ten-dimensional string theory. So, and again, I don't have a deep insight into that, except that that seems to be what we are at this point we are using to reproduce the very detailed features of ten-dimensional string theory. When I say detailed features, it will be, in the previous case, I didn't reproduce that Lagrangian with all the couplings, but in this case, we actually can now begin to reproduce full string field theory with cubic couplings and fairly detailed features.
So in basically,
space-time
doesn't count.
It is reproduced by this Ichikawai matrix. I call them DI, four of them, or three. So in some sense, it's again quantum mechanics. But again, that is not a very, it's more of an empirical statement.
But is it maybe a hidden duality between short and long distances? Because the dimensional reduction is typically that you go to the zero momentum sector, which would mean the long distance part. But you know, in string theory, that sometimes by dual mapping, it's related to short distances.
Yeah, I don't know whether I can think with that way. But I have no good way of explaining this reduction. It has to do with the fact that many of the operators which you construct in Jan-Niels theory, we receive very large corrections. And then there, anomalous dimensions. And then there will be a subset of operators called chiral primaries and their descendants, which we receive no correction. And then there'll be in that sense, it comes from some very detailed issue of how quantum corrections influence your scaling dimensions of operators. And that's why I cannot think of why this reduction happens. Because we find it through this question of how, whether the operators receive large corrections or not. Okay. Let's see, where I think we have time to stick it back better. Okay, 20 minutes. Let me try to then see. Let me then choose what I will say. And luckily, Sorang is here, so he'll be able to then give a real review to the subject. Yes, so. As we move to Young, we would like to move to Jan-Niels theory. And I already emphasized that in this 10-dimensional super Jan-Niels theory we have the scalar fields which couple in a certain way in the Lagrangian. The symmetry which you will see right away, because there are six scalars, you'll see an SO6. You will also see SO24, which is what happens to the conformal symmetry, but now we moved up from SO21, which was the symmetry here. We move up to SO. I moved up by how many dimensions? By 3, and 1 is 4. So SO24 is nothing but the conformal group in four dimensions. So again, conformal transformations, which I will actually comment on pretty soon, and dilatations and translations and all those. And as I said, the global symmetry of SO6, which comes just because it has six scalar fields. They're in a way very simple. Why super Jan-Niels? That's just because that is a theory which has beta function is zero and no quantum corrections, and conformal symmetry will still be there, and many of the simple minded calculations will be valid. And indeed, in this theory you will have a lot of traces. But then you start analyzing, and you see that they are governed by the conformal group. are the so-called chiral primaries, and the relevance of those operators, which I'm about to list, is that they actually, their conformal dimension or scaling dimension is the naive dimension is just correct at the full quantum level. So if you want, that is the reason, really. That's the power of supersymmetry.
The name chiral primaries comes from string theory.
No, the name comes in relation to this super conformal group. It has to do with just the fact that you start with the lowest weight, the highest weight, the operator which I listed here, which is a chiral primary, and then you generate descendants by actions of the group.
Okay.
So it's really just the group theory of SO24 which plays a role. Okay. And the conjecture, as I have repeated it a couple of times then, is that this Young-Mills theory is equivalent to ten-dimensional string theory, or gravity, in a 5 + 5 dimensional background. This is a sphere, and this is also the ADS sphere, so product, the direct sum of two spheres. That is what we have been studying up to now, just that there was only T and Z, and there was no three-dimensional X. Now I just added that one in. And again, there will be 5 more dimensions to represent this sphere. And altogether, if you think about it, it is T and X, one extra dimension to make this into 5, ADS 5, and 5 dimensions here. So it is very quick to see that we have 6 scalar fields. And if I think of a scalar field as, even though it is a matrix, and that logic is maybe, I can separate a unit variable versus the radial variable. It is this which, in my logic of taking traces, which ultimately will result in this extra dimension of the ADS, which is needed, and it is this which will build a 5 sphere, which is S5. So the number, certainly, of this scalar fields is just appropriate to reproduce. We had T and X, and now we are adding Z, so that will be ADS5, and then we have S5, which is coming from there.
This is
yes.
You can see the 6. How sure is that this is?
So now I will give arguments.
I mean the identification.
Yes. So now I will give some checks of how this.
No, not the conjecture. Indeed, it is that the Z should be sort of going out of the cube.
Yes. Okay. So since that is one thing I can illuminate, and I think it might be useful. So. One comparison which was done early, obviously the comparison of scaling dimensions of operators in Young-Mills versus quantum numbers in gravity. And that matched very well. But again, there were no corrections there. Another comparison which you'll see often is something when you compare correlation functions. Correlation functions in Young-Mills theory for some of those operators that I listed typically are just 1 over x minus y to the power of the scaling dimension. And if you now look at a scalar field with certain mass in the ADS space, which is one extra dimension, you study the corresponding Klein-Gordon type equation and evaluate the wave functions, and then evaluate the correlation function. You obviously will not be able to compare that correlation functions with the correlation functions of phi of x and z because there is one extra dimension. And that's why the first comparison involved is projection to the boundary, where the comparison was performed by projecting the ADS correlation functions, and in this picture of ADS space where I think of the boundary to be at z equals 0, you are projecting to the boundary and comparing correlation functions on the boundary. But yes, that even though it works out nicely, and when you look at ADS correlation functions, you do reproduce the same type of result, but now with this kind of scaling dimension, and that is a good match between what operator in Young-Mills theory will correspond to what field in string theory of gravity. But it doesn't really test ADS space in any detail, because again, the comparison has to be done near z equals 0.
If I take one of these topological twists of n equals 4 Young-Mills, are there ADS CFT correspondences for that? Because presuming the geometry will be different in those cases.
There are many cases which were studied.
Because they don't have necessarily six scalar fields.
And there are many deformations of n equals 4 Young-Mills itself, which are direct deformations by adding extra terms. Even those have been studied. So, in fact, there are many nice examples which are pretty close nowadays to what you'd like to see in QCD. Ray might be able to tell you about that. So I will just finish by this question of the fact that that there might be still some deep question you might be asking. And the fact that in one case, conformal symmetry, for example, is realized in five dimensions, and in the other case, in the Young-Mills theory, the conformal symmetry is realized in four dimensions. So how do we kind of reconcile the two? And if I phrase the question in the following way, if I look at the five-dimensional, I think I have lost that instrument. If I look at the conformal transformation, just to remind you, of a typical conformal transformation in Young-Mills theory, delta x is roughly x squared times epsilon. And compare that with the appropriate analog, which would be the symmetry in ADS space. And now I have my ADS space is dx squared. U squared is the extra dimension. It is 1 over z in my previous notation. And if you look at the symmetry of this metric, which is, again, just a rotation, nothing much, after all, it was just a sphere, then the analog would be du being 2 epsilon times u, and dx would be a term which is very much what you see in four-dimensional Young-Mills theory, which is this, 2 epsilon x and x squared, and then a u-dependent term. R4, the radius of this space, R participates now explicitly, and maybe there was a question about such a radius before, R4 divided by u squared. And yes, it pays to go to the boundary if you are in business of comparison, because boundary means that z is equal to 0 or u goes to infinity, so this extra term would drop out, and indeed this reduces to that. So that comparison of correlation functions in the boundary that uses just actually not the full symmetry of ADS as realized in five dimension, but just the four-dimensional reduction of it. But you might say, I would like to perform a comparison which is not at u equal infinity, and can we do that? And the answer is, can we see such a term coming out from Young-Mills theory directly? So let me now give you kind of very quick calculation that you can do that. And this is a paper we have written with Yonera and Kazama, so that was precisely the topic we wanted to understand, how to maybe reproduce the term which I emphasized, which is a typical five-dimensional term. How do we see that in Young-Mills theory? And to begin seeing that in Young-Mills theory, we then say the following. We expect that extra dimension, comes from the magnitude of the Higgs field. So let's study Young-Mills theory in the presence of some classical non-zero expectation value or background, classical background for the Higgs, and I will call the background B. Okay? So let's look at the Young-Mills theory in the background or classical background B. Typically you fix a background gauge, and those are the steps which you do if you have to do two calculations. You fix a background gauge and the background features in your gauge fixing, covariant gauge fixing, right here, these are really the scalar fields being split into the background and fluctuation, so there will be such a term in our background gauge. And if you now go back to asking the questions, how does conformal symmetry look like once I have a non-zero Higgs background, you'll see that this gauge condition, which is a background gauge and any other background gauge, you won't find the one which will not do what I say, any other gauge condition will violate conformal symmetry just because the Higgs field has a dimension and any classical value will violate conformal symmetry. If you perform a conformal transformation of this gauge fixing term, you get terms which are proportional to that gauge fixing term, and then an exciton, epsilon times A. So you might say that is conformal symmetry broken once I have this background, or what, that would not fit well with any of the things I have discussed. But this phenomena is well known, that sometimes background gauges, like for monopoles, might break Lorentz symmetry. It doesn't mean that monopole, which is present in the theory, will that is a breaking of Lorentz symmetry. So if we borrow a similar discussion from how Lorentz symmetry is restored in the case of monopoles, there is obviously it's called a compensating gauge transformation, where you can compensate for that extra breaking. So you just introduce a gauge transformation which will compensate for that. And if you think along this line, then, that's important. Transparency is here. So once you are you have a non-trivial background in Young-Mills theory, then the conformal symmetry will not just be this naive term, which you would naively think, but there is also a gauge transformation, the so-called compensating gauge transformation. Looks very non-local because it has the inverse of a covariant derivative where the background sits and that gauge field here and our scalar field which is transformed. Anyway, you'll get a good impression of what this does if you just take an expectation value. It will quickly lead to a computation of a simple one-loop diagram. And the one-loop diagram is d4k over k squared and power 3, there will be 3 propagators. And that gives you precisely 1 over b squared, gives you the power of Young-Mills coupling g squared and n. And that form, which you now add to my conformal transformation, is precisely the formula which you have in ADS space. So this is the kind of simplest derivation, if you like, of how that realization of symmetry happens, and how, not only how it happens, it also specifies, and that question was asked, what the correspondence is between the Young-Mills coupling constant and then g squared n, which appears here, divided by b squared, which is the expectation value of the Higgs field, versus the ADS radius R4 and that variable u squared. So this is the simplest calculation I know, which will maybe satisfy some of you, to give at least some inkling of how not only the comparison on the boundary, but some comparison like that, where you are able to reproduce the conformal, the full realization in 5 dimension now appears. I think with that.
Would it be stupid to say that holography in this case is equivalent to the fact that the gauge degree of freedom is not a physical degree of freedom?
I'm not the wrong person to ask about holography.
Because you said at a different radius,
yes,
which is not a boundary, but it has the same information,
yeah,
and on the gauge side, it's a gauge, compensating gauge transformation.
So, yeah. I am a big opponent of boundaries. I somehow from the beginning never liked the boundary. But there are many questions to whether from boundary data, for example, there are deep questions, whether from boundary data you can reconstruct the theory. And some usually ordinarily you can do. That is typically related to the absolute case. The only case that you might not be able to do is precisely ADS. So I'm not sure.
But it would make it for me much more transparent. If there's an equivalent model where the radio parameter is a gauge parameter, then for me it's trivial that there's a logarithm.
Yeah, I know. But here I think we are pretty convinced that this radio parameter has something to do with the Higgs field.
Yeah.
And that puts... Yeah, so I don't have a good intuition of what's going on. There's something going on which I have some little understanding of.
And
all those extra dimensions which I explained today are directly related to fields. I only lately, after so much time, began to understand that some extra dimensions might come from out of blue. Maybe renormalization scales and so on, but yeah. I have no coherent way of expressing that. But it's not inconceivable, and I just cannot give you a good example of how that works. I would love to give such an example. That's another most interesting topic, which yes.
One way that I know where you go from one direction. Our dimension, your dimension, has to do with localization fields, and I don't see it here at all. But you did say something about a Higgs field. If there's a kink, we know that things will localize in the boundary, and then maybe
To me this was just a projection. Indeed, the ADS conformal transformation or any other, might often involve this extra dimension explicitly. And there are things in ADS space which will involve the extra dimension. Black holes are one, where they have a horizon, and so on. So we are actually very interested in going into this ADS space. So there are things which we know are somewhere there. I think there are many subjects. This is probably of half of what I intended to do. There's a very interesting subject of continuing along the line of taking a lot of traces of these matrices and building up string field theory. There's a particular limit called PT limit, or there's a particular extension of Mogesenov's conjecture called the Bernstein-Nassase and Mogesenov conjecture. While here we only saw gravity, they were able to give you a prescription of how to see full 10-dimensional string theory. So there are a lot of very nice calculations done during the last year where that was done. There's a lot of nice things done in reconciling this, as we emphasized, moving from n equal 4 to something which is physical. So hopefully all those things what I could give is maybe just an introduction from a particular way of looking at the problem. Okay. Thanks.